Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
You've been running for your life, exposed to the elements, and your health is taking a turn for the worse.
Sometimes raining, sometimes snowing, sometimes windy, sometimes storm. After some days, I get sick. I need just to sleep, and I want to be better.
Caring for refugees in camps when rain, despair, and disease are taking over. I'm Maiken Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
You measure a sample, but you measure millions and billions of molecules all at the same time.
You get to see these patients over and over again. They become part of your family.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
You know, everything falls apart.
How about a bag of frozen peas to keep you comfy? Plus,
bingo.
So here's this population that never gets studied.
Pretty much all of cell biology
needs
to kind of be redone.
I first opened a little box
before anesthesia.
All of the surgeries that have not prior to yet.
We're just giving you some of the medicine for your IV.
Basically, we wanted to know if there was any point to doing it.
On today's show, music as distraction when your body is giving up the ghost. Music as transition when your spirit is leaving your body. Real fear that you might not be able to do one aspect of your job. And imagined fear that gives you thrills and chills. But first up, a look at healthcare in the midst of Europe's worst refugee crisis since World War II. More than a million refugees and migrants entered Europe in 2015. Many of them were fleeing wars in Syria and Iraq and endured really long, harrowing journeys. Those who are hoping to build new lives in England often end up getting stuck in northeastern France, where the English Channel is separating them from their destination. Thousands of people are awaiting their fate in tents cities in this region. Reporter Brenna Daldorf visited one of these migrant camps and has this report.
It's pouring when I get to the migrant camp in the Bazrock neighborhood in Consant, a town in northern France. The ground on this empty lot is nothing but mud and water. Shabby tents all around me sink into it. I'm looking at one collapsing tent when I step and sink calf deep into the mud. It's hard to believe that people live here, but they do. At peak time in January this year, more than 2,500 people were crowded into this tent city, waiting in the mud for a chance to get over the border and into England. I'm getting soaked when a young man greets me.
Hey.
He invites me to drink tea with his family. He's lucky it's dry in his tent.
My name is Mubarak from Kuwait.
While most people in the Bazrock camp are Kurdish, there are some minorities from other countries. Mubarak's a Bedouin, a group of stateless nomads who face a lot of discrimination in Kuwait. He and his brothers arrived in Grandsant 3 months ago.
A lot of people get sick here because, as you know, your condition here is very, very bad. Sometimes raining, sometimes snowing, sometimes windy, sometimes storm.
So when did you start feeling sick?
When we arrived here. After some days, I get sick.
Can you describe how you feel?
Very, very tired. I need just to sleep and I want to be better. There is a center care here of medicine. Thank you for them to come here, really. They doing as best as they can, but we need more.
Mubarak is full of praise for the doctors who work on site. Doctors Without Borders, known in France as Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, is one of the medical charities that provides free healthcare in the Bazrock migrant camp. MSF works in humanitarian camps for refugees all over the world, in places like Syria and South Sudan. Yet even these hardcore MSF doctors were appalled by the conditions in this makeshift camp in a sleepy French suburb. That's why the organization joined forces with the local mayor at the end of 2015 to construct a brand new camp for these refugees. They decided to do it without funding from the national government. That's because France is opposed to building permanent structures for migrants, sticking to the line that they're worried it will attract more people. But the mayor of Consant and MSF couldn't leave these people in the flooded tent city. The new camp is located less than a mile and a half away. It cost over 3 million euros to build, but it will be up to international humanitarian standards. When it's finished, it'll be the first of its kind in France. But on that rainy day I find myself in the Bazrak camp, completion of the new camp is still several weeks away, and it keeps getting delayed. While it's being built, the people in the old camp just have to wait and wait in the rain and the mud. Some of the residents have formed a line, waiting to see the MSF doctors in the little compound they set up. There's a reception desk in a small hut. Another hut holds a makeshift pharmacy. Shivering patients gather under a tarp as rain drums down. There, I meet Angelique Mueller. She's the project coordinator for MSF in this camp.
In terms of medical, so we have a huge proportion of higher and lower respiratory tract infection linked to this condition, the winter condition. So we have some child as well with otitis, rhinopharyngitis.
Quick translation, rhinopharyngitis is the common cold and otitis is an ear infection.
We have a lot of scabies.
Scabies is a nasty skin disease, a result of unhygienic living conditions, the mud, and the damp, and the fact that there are about 30 showers for nearly 3,000 people living here. Besides that, lots of people tell me it's too cold to use the outside showers. Angelique also explains that people with long-term illnesses or medical conditions often run out of medicine on their journey. MSF doctors have prescribed medicine for epilepsy, hypertension, asthma, and diabetes, to name a few.
Have people gotten injuries from the journey? Well, I mean, people have traveled so far.
For the journey, they are not coming in the bad condition. I mean, like physically. The mental health, it's another topic. They are traumatized. This is quite obvious.
In the new camp, Angelique says there'll be space for a psychiatrist. One comes to the Bazrak camp sometimes, but she isn't in today. Later, I speak with a young mother from Iraqi Kurdistan who lives in one of the most flooded parts of the camp. She's waiting to see a doctor for her son, who's 11 months old.
Sava, are you okay? What is the baby's name?
Chewar.
Chewar? And what is your name?
Shaima.
Shaima. I'm Brenna.
Shaima okays me to sit in on the appointment. Through the translator, we learn that Iwa has had a high fever for 5 days. His breathing is ragged. Pascal, the MSF doctor, puts him on the cold examining table to take a look. She thinks he might have a urinary infection. She decides that he needs to go to the hospital for further tests. A few minutes later, I go with Shaima and several members of MSF to take Iwa to the local hospital. We arrive at the emergency room in less than 15 minutes. We're caked in mud in the clean hospital lobby. The French government provides hospitals with a special budget to cover costs for emergency health care for undocumented immigrants. The translator answers the receptionist's questions in French. Shaima doesn't understand what they're saying. She holds her son tightly, and tears stream down her cheeks. I have to stop recording at this point. When Shaima, Iwa, and the translator disappear behind double doors, I leave. I kept trying to find out what happened to them, but no one could tell me. A few weeks later, I go back to Grand Saint to see the new camp. MSF and the local city hall built it in a record 2 months. Moving 2,500 people from the Bazrak camp took 3 days. The first thing I notice is that there's no mud. Officials explain that a special kind of tarp was implanted in the ground to keep water from rising. The spring sun shines on the dusty brown earth. Kids play on bikes. One kid is wearing rollerblades while riding a bike. For as far as I can see, there are rows and rows of little wooden huts. They're unfurnished one-room buildings. Some families have already added lopsided additions out of tarp. Colorful laundry flaps in the wind. There are shower blocks and toilet facilities. In the nightmare that was the old Bazrak camp, all anyone could think about were the most immediate health concerns. The cold, the flooded tents and soaked clothes, the respiratory infections, the scabies. At the new camp, I start to see other injuries, many related to the journey that these people have undergone. A highway runs by the camp, and every night people still try to jump on trucks bound for England. I speak to one man whose wife fell off a moving truck and hurt her back. Volunteers point out another man in a cast who shattered his leg in the same way. I see another man on crutches. He got injured playing football, but it means he's trapped in the camp for the foreseeable future. Another person who can't make the crossing is Faris. He's 21, a Bedouin from Kuwait. Faris is young and healthy, but his mom isn't.
What is she sick with? What does your mother have?
My mother, she have anemia, rheumatism, she have asthma.
Faris says that the journey has been really hard on his mom. She had an asthma attack when running away from police in Greece. The bad diet on the journey gave her stomach problems. They visited 3 hospitals since leaving their home. He's too afraid to try and get on a truck with her. Jumping on a moving truck is also unthinkable for Jeanne and Saba, a Kurdish-Iraqi couple. They have 4 young children. The youngest is just 6 months old. Jeanne invites me into their hut. There's no furniture there, except some folding chairs. They sleep on blankets piled on the floor. Her 7-year-old son, Shkar, has a big bandage on his shoulder. He gestures to tell me what happened. He and his 3-year-old sister both got burned when they knocked over a heater. They tell me the story with smiles and animation, but their injuries look painful and their parents look sad. Burns from fires and heaters are one of the most common injuries in both the old and new camps. During my last visit to the Bazrak camp, an MSF doctor told me they were treating up to 10 burns a day from people trying to stay warm. This family fled the Islamic State group, which was advancing on their hometown of Kirkuk in northern Iraq. They traveled through 8 countries to get here. They tell me about spending freezing nights outside with the baby and toddler. Both parents cry remembering it. Saba gets out his phone to show me photos of the kids wearing life jackets on the boat from Turkey to Greece.
Oh, is that on the boat?
Yeah, in Greece.
Oh, in Greece.
Athena.
That's you, yeah.
Jeanne wants me to understand something. She points to her kids. Aylan, she says, shivering. Aylan is the name of the tiny baby boy photographed dead on the beaches of Turkey. His family was fleeing from Syria. He drowned when the flimsy boat they were in capsized. Jeanne points to each of her kids and repeats it. Aylan, Aylan. With haunted eyes, she's saying, that could have been my child. Saba and Jeanne left Iraq to save their children from bombs and the terror of war. But they tell me they feel guilty for putting their kids through all this fear and confusion. Now, the family is trapped in a drafty hut in northern France, unsure of where to go or what to do. And that is what makes them sickest of all. For The Pulse, I'm Brenna Daldorf.
Hello?
Very good.
Hello? Hello?
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. By the time refugees resettle in a new country and find a permanent home, a lot of them carry huge emotional burdens. The suffering they endured in their home country, the terror and hardship of their journey, the long wait for their new life to finally begin. Psychologist David Goodwin works with refugees at Belmont Behavioral Hospital in Philadelphia, and he joins us now to talk more about the mental health aspects of this issue. David, thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome, Megan.
Tell me about the refugees you work with and how they end up in your office.
So refugees are fleeing their homelands due to fear of persecution or even fear of death. I've seen individuals and families from the Sudan, Somalia, Eritrea, Iraq, Sierra Leone, Congo, Angola, Guinea, Bhutan, Nepal. So we're seeing individuals whose adaptational capacities have really been stretched to the max. I've heard stories of gang rape by soldiers, prison guards, kidnapping, torture, and slavery. They've lived through the violent breakdown and dismantling of a social structure and their former way of life.
Tell me about how you talk. When a refugee comes to your office and is clearly distressed, how do you begin a conversation?
People are looking for a safe space to reclaim their trust in humanity, though it would be a mistake to think that all of the conversation and therapy is focused on these past traumas. Sometimes they want to talk about just the adaptational challenges of living in a host country in a radically different culture.
Like what? Give me an example.
The model for refugee resettlement is that refugees are allocated certain benefits only for a fixed period of time. The expectation is that they're self-sufficient within 8 months. Oftentimes, people are very confused and overwhelmed by just navigating complicated social systems in a foreign culture. And so some of the work is going to be geared towards building available resources and connecting people with reliable social support systems.
The notion of therapy, to go see somebody to talk about what your troubles are, is a Western concept. So how do these refugees look at that concept of going to talk to somebody like you about their personal problems?
That can be a little bit of a challenge. For example, there's one British psychiatrist, Derek Summerfield, who talks about the case of working with a Sudanese patient. And after the third session, the Sudanese patient said to the doctor, "Doctor, your words are very kind, but when are you actually going to help me? We in the West are very preoccupied with our inner processes. Oftentimes, people from different cultures are less concerned with that and want to get on with the task of rebuilding their lives. They want to get on with repairing the social fabric. For example, growing home gardens. That's a large community garden in South Philadelphia that was started by Nationality Service Center in 2008, shortly after they began settling refugees from Burma and Nepal. Now, these migrants have agricultural roots, and they wanted to create a safe and peaceful space for growing nutritional and traditional food crops in the city. You could see why that's really important, because it links the former life with the new life. I know that there have been mural arts projects, photo voice projects, anything that allows creative outlets, dance workshops. So anything that is repairing of the social fabric, I would argue, can have a healing quality.
David, thank you so much.
Mike, and you're welcome. Thank you very much.
David Goodwin is a psychologist at Belmont Behavioral Hospital in Philadelphia, and I have been to the garden in South Philadelphia that he described, where refugees are growing vegetables and get together to celebrate, and we have great photos of that garden on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Coming up, a former biochemistry student is reborn on an operating table as a singer.
Without a grease, we weathered we, we're putting knots.
Her story is coming up next on The Pulse.
Engaged to us with all the trees and what else is.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find our podcast on iTunes. What do you do when you're losing control over your body, your ability to move, to lift things, to get around, even just to get up one single step? You could scream at your fate, or you could start singing. In the wake of becoming disabled, a Philadelphia woman created a whole new identity for herself, and songwriting has become her outlet. She told us her story for our series, Patient Files.
My name is Anami. I go by Anami Fatale for music and other creative work. Do you want my legal name? Or okay, legally, my name is Kellyanne Murray. Actually, the word is anami. It's a term in nihilism for somebody who doesn't really apply to any standards or norms, is kind of like an outlier in society. And that's how I feel like, you know, involuntarily people with disabilities are. So when I became disabled at age 20, I, you know, being a social anime, I decided, kind of accepting a new identity, that I would take on that name.
It's a flawless regret. It's a
I went to college in South Jersey at Richard Stockton College, New Jersey, and was studying biochemistry, and life was all good, able-bodied, and getting good grades, and just had like really bright, happy future stuff, and then just had some headaches and vision stuff, and then everything got very, very different very fast. It's a picture of you. So I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. What that means is it's a genetic condition that means I have a lack of collagen, which is basically like the stuff that keeps the body together. And when you are defective in it, all of your joints, organs, things like that are just a little bit more like fragile. So I kind of tell people like I'm made out of bubble gum. I have quadriparesis, which is like being quadriplegic, but you can move everything. You just don't have any strength. I can lift like up to like 2 or 3 pounds, but I can't like lift anything more than that. I can't bend. It's a very different life when you go from being able to go up steps to when you can't go up steps. Like, your whole social everything just changes because it's the matter of being able to like get into anywhere you want, live anywhere you want to. So, yeah, that was a big change. The fight for life's just a little thing. Performing for me is just like, I don't know, it's like that time where I feel like all the stuff I go through like has a purpose. I don't know, because it's like it's my platform to not only like express myself, but yeah, like just get out there like all the problems that is going on for like my community and just be myself. Hoping for a home that I can feel my own feels again, and none of them will be of the believe that someday this will all turn out where like I had to go through all this to get to a better place that like I never would have gotten to otherwise. I don't believe in like fate and all that stuff, but I think that it's like you have to give meaning to things that you go through, because just make it worth it. Wondering why it's taking so long for the woods to sink into the mud. Make the monsters aware we won't be caught in a prison of care.
Kellyanne Murray performs under the name Anami Fatal. She has a connective tissue disorder. Todd Bookman produced this piece. Our next story is also about the healing effects of music, but we're going to move on from moody guitar music to the beautiful sounds of the harp. Those soothing notes are floating through Lehi Hospital outside of Boston, Massachusetts, to help make patients feel comfortable at the end of life, Paige Flager reports.
Right now, you're hearing two things. The first is the sound of a harp. It's being played by Jennifer Hollis. The second is the sound of an oxygen tank humming in the corner. A clear tube leads to Susan Steinbauer. She's laying in her hospital bed with her eyes closed, her hands folded over a blue crocheted blanket. She's 64 and has terminal cancer. When the music stops, Steinbauer opens her eyes.
It actually brought me back to a certain place in my childhood that, when you're little, you run so free. And that's what it was. It was like the freedom feeling.
Well, would you like more music? Do you feel like that's enough for now? It's totally up to you.
I could do another one.
Yeah? Another one?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jennifer Hollis is more than a harpist. She's what's called a music thanatologist. She plays the harp and sings for dying patients. So, if life was a movie, Hollis plays the music during the closing credits. Her profession is really rare. She's the only music thanatologist in the northeastern United States, and there are less than 100 music thanatologists worldwide. She had never heard about this field until she came across an article back in 1995. She had played music all her life and decided that this was something that she really wanted to explore.
At that point, it sounded very strange to people that someone who was about to graduate from college was going to go off and move from the Boston area. And the only training program at that time in the world was in Missoula, Montana. So my plan was to graduate from college and move to Missoula, which is exactly what I did. So I think that, to me, that sounded like a great adventure.
She took classes in anthropology, music theory, anatomy, and physiology, and she had regular voice and harp lessons. The defining characteristic of music thanatology is what Hollis calls the prescriptive process. She explains that music thanatologists think of the raw elements of music, like melody, harmony, rhythm, and tonality, and then they use those things to respond to different moods of hospital rooms.
So if a patient has restlessness, agitation, I would start thinking prescriptively about what are the qualities of music that might be able to address that in some way.
For the last 10 years, Hollis has been going to Lehi Hospital outside of Boston to play for dying patients. Sometimes the patient response is physical. They might breathe more deeply or their facial expression might relax. More often than not, she'll play a room full of people straight to sleep. But she's not insulted by that.
It's such a compliment because it means that people are, they're relaxed, that they feel safe and they feel comfortable.
Other times, the response to the music is really emotional, and not just for the patients. Families might use this time to tell stories about their loved one, to pray, or to say goodbye.
The interesting thing about music thanatology, I think, is that in some ways it's medicine that you can give both to the patient and to their family.
There's not a whole lot of research backing up the benefits of music thanatology. Beth Collins is the medical director of Lehi Hospital's palliative care program. She says that at first, when she heard about Jennifer Hollis and her work, she was really worried that her unit might be seen as soft or touchy-feely by other doctors. That is, until she saw Jennifer Hollis in action. Then, she didn't really care about the science.
I don't think things have to be proven. I think they just have to work. And to me, my God, this is a heck of a lot better than giving somebody some medication that's going to change things going on in their body. If her work is able to help a heart rate slow down and someone not breathe as hard and be more comfortable, that's better than anything, I think.
Colin says there's only been one complaint about Jennifer Hollis in the time that she's been visiting the hospital.
The only thing is sometimes some patients' families have said, oh my God, no. If my father ever opened his eyes and saw somebody with a harp near his bed, he would think he had already died.
But the harp reminding people of those pearly white gates isn't always a bad thing, Hollis says.
I think for some people, it's evocative in a very positive way, where they love the idea that their loved one, especially if they're not conscious and speaking anymore, might hear the music and feel like they were in heaven.
This story was reported by Paige Flager, and the patient we heard from in the beginning of the story, Susan Steinbauer, passed away last month. Coming up, is there one aspect of your career, of your job, that really scares you? Something that you feel like, what if I can't do this? What if I do it wrong? We'll talk about that and we'll hear how people have overcome those fears. That's next on The Pulse. We'll be right back. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. When I first started working in radio, I had a big problem, and that was the fact that I used to get so nervous that if I had to do anything live, like read the news or do a live report, I could barely talk, and my hands would shake so badly that it was hard for me to hold the microphone. Eventually, I got over that fear just by doing this over and over and over again and by delivering some really terrible live reports. And a lot of us have these fears associated with our jobs. One thing that we think, what if I can't do this? What if I can't get over this? Emily Bingham is a journalist from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and right now is a pretty tough time to be a journalist, so that got her thinking about a career change, and she wanted to get into the health field. To get started, she took some anatomy classes at her community college, and eventually she signed up for some more hands-on training as a certified nurse's assistant. Everything seemed fine until she hit a major roadblock.
I have a list, and these are 50 skills that we have to learn how to do in order to pass this class. And I'm going down the list, and it's like hand washing, taking and recording an oral temperature. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be no problem. And then I get to assist using a bedpan and collect urine stool specimens. And then something that says perineal care. I don't even know what this is, but I'm stuck on the stool specimen. Like, oh my God, there's poop involved. I'm going to have to touch a butt. And that was my first, like, oh man, you are in a whole new world. The thought of working with strangers in that capacity was really terrifying to me. To me, it was the deciding factor. You know, can I touch a patient? Or will I be totally grossed out or too chicken to do certain things? If I didn't enjoy this, I was going to kind of give it up. So this was like a really big deal for me. So I should say that, mercifully, before you're touching anybody in clinicals, they have you practice on a mannequin. And they're male or female based on this removable, detachable genitalia that you can pull out or stick back into the mannequin. And then the teacher turns the mannequin on its side to do care in the rear. I'm not even sure how I'm best to say that. Bottom, to care for their bottom. And she describes the actual cleaning. Can I say anus? She describes the actual cleaning of the anus as a swoop. So I learned how to do a swoop on a mannequin. And, you know, you do it on a mannequin on these little plastic parts and you think, I got this. But then when you're faced with actually doing it on a real human being who's lying in a bed and really in an extremely vulnerable position, it's totally different, obviously. I should have expected that, but it is, you know, I wasn't ready. So the day arrives. We get broken down into groups. Each group is assigned a resident for that morning, and we're responsible for their care for that morning. We're there to dress them if they are to get dressed, assist with eating if they need assistance with eating, and then, yeah, do a full bed bath. So we do her face. Face is easy. We do her arms, do her legs and her feet, and the whole time I'm actually thinking, like, there's this hurdle at the end. We're going to have to, like, get in there. So, my teammate was in charge of the swoop, but there was more swoopage that needed to happen, if you know what I mean. So I also did some swoops, and there was poop. But you know what? When you're in the moment, you just do it. Like, to be totally honest, a butt is just a butt. And we finished up, and the woman was super grateful, and you could tell she was feeling good and clean and ready for her day. And I went home that day and I was like, okay, I can do this. I think the profound takeaway for me was how much we need each other as humans. And there is a time, I think, in most people's lives where you really need other people. And it was immensely gratifying to help people who needed that kind of help. And it was basic help, like washing somebody's hair, you know, like so simple, but like, man, that made a difference in that person's day. Okay, we had a mock election in the class. One of the categories was person you most want to be your RN. And my classmates nominated me for that. You know, I'm going to try not to cry right now. Like, it made a huge impact on me. I don't know if I'd want to go into, like, gastroenterology or something. but I can do it. I'm really proud that I can do it.
Emily's story was produced by Lou Bluin, and he tells us that Emily is still working as a full-time reporter, but she continues to take healthcare classes. We also asked our listeners to weigh in on this issue of fear associated with your job, and a lot of you shared your stories. Let's take a listen.
My name is Kate McGill-Armento, and I'm a nurse practitioner. When I think about what I fear most in my role, although I have moments of being afraid of contracting an infectious disease or making a mistake that could hurt one of my patients or myself, my biggest fear has been of burning out psychologically and not being able to continue performing this amazing role that I love, helping others.
Kate also said that she used to work as a trauma nurse, but that was just too emotionally difficult for her, and she switched to a more preventive care setting. We also heard from Kathleen. She is a physical therapist, and she said in her very first job, she had a really difficult patient, and she was scared that she couldn't handle him. He had substance use issues, he was homeless, and he had suffered a stroke.
He had no function on the left side of his body when he first had a stroke, and he directed all of his anger at me. And his mother and sister attended every session and begged me not to give up on him, and I didn't. And slowly he started getting better, and as he got better, he softened and he started to work with me instead of against me, and he started to look around the gym and see the other patients that were even worse off than he was, and he became a real cheerleader for them. And it was so heartening to see, and such a lesson in perseverance for both of us.
We also heard from emergency room physician Beth Lovell, and she said that a lot of times she has to make quick decisions based on very limited information, and her big fear is that she'll miss something or not have any immediate answers for her patients.
If I don't find a diagnosis, which happens more often in medicine than doctors would like to admit, I'm honest about that. And I always encourage patients to trust their instincts and return to the hospital if they need to. I've had patients who I've worried about after I've discharged them, and I call them sometimes the next day to see if they're okay. It's a safety net for both of us.
Thank you so much to all of you who shared your thoughts on this topic. And if you want to weigh in the future, just find The Pulse on Facebook. That's usually where we get the conversation started. We're going to stick with fear for our next story. When it's experienced in a safe environment, those adrenaline rushes are kind of enjoyable. People love roller coasters, haunted houses, horror movies, so it's probably no wonder that the Japanese fad of escape rooms has spread all over the world. It works like this. People get locked into a room with a group of people. You pay good money for this. And then you have to solve a series of puzzles to get out. How do our brains respond to this self-imposed pressure? Elizabeth Fiedler reports.
Hey everyone, my name is Hank. I will be your clue master today.
A group of coworkers from a healthcare consulting firm is gathered in the lower level of a tall office building in Philadelphia. A friendly guy named Game Master Hank is laying out the challenge they'll tackle for the next 60 minutes.
Basically, you're going to go inside this room. I'm going to lock the door. You have 1 hour to figure out how to escape.
Pretty simple. Got it. Game Master Hank advises us to explore every nook and cranny, but not to go too far.
The room itself is not part of the puzzle. It's a container for the puzzle. What that means is there's nothing hidden under the carpet or in the wall or the ceiling. The electrical sockets are functional electrical sockets. They are not magical keyholes.
That warning gives you some idea just how competitive people get. To get out of this room, like others, the group needs to follow a series of hints and discover physical clues that are located in the room.
All right, great. Let's get started.
Hank leads us in and closes the door. Actually, the scene's more like this.
Yeah, let's just start finding clues, I guess.
A woman in a red sweater went right for a purple post-it note, a white paper, and the clock. She took the clock off the wall. And, I don't know, she's moving around like she's got ideas.
To stay organized and focused, they start compiling clues on a desk. The space looks like an office, which makes sense, since these coworkers have chosen a game called The Office as their adventure for the night. There are drop ceiling tiles, white walls, cubicle dividers, and industrial blue and purple carpet. It could be a healthcare consulting firm or a real estate company. While they're working, a digital clock on the wall shows the minutes slipping away. Art Markman, a psychology professor at the University of Texas at Austin, says all of this running around trying to decode clues is good.
There's a lot of benefit to activity on your mood. So even getting up and taking a walk tends to lift your mood because you do get a bit of a release of dopamine, which is correlated with positive mood. That increases even more when you engage in fast thinking.
Fast thinking, like the type you'd have to engage in to escape from wizard school. That's a puzzle room located in Markman's town of Austin, Texas.
One of the things we know from a lot of research over the last 10 or 12 years is that the faster you're thinking, the better you feel. And when you're in a social group and working on a problem together and really engaging in that kind of energy, what that energy does is it makes everyone in the group think faster, and that actually elevates people's moods.
Back in the fake office she's trying to escape, Donnell is standing next to a large black desk trying to understand a code, or at least what she thinks could be a code.
But they don't fit, do they? Because there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, not 6. We need 6.
To keep the details of the game a secret, I've agreed not to give too much away. Laura, the woman in the red sweater, organized this escape. I ask her if it's easier or harder than she expected.
Harder? Just because I feel like we're so disorganized right now.
Are you the sort of person who likes to be organized?
I think we all are. We're a bunch of type A's, like, in a room. So I think we're, like, half battling teamwork and half battling, like, can we win?
One of the players, Jordan, says that after working with these people for more than 2 years, he's seeing a different side of them.
I think people are actually coming out of their shell a little bit. I think people actually feel more comfortable here, and they're actually being more outgoing than they are typically in the office.
Psychologists say we can actually learn a lot from how people behave in escape rooms. Kevin Swartout is a social psychologist and assistant professor at Georgia State University. He says people often behave differently and are more willing to speak up with opinions and expertise when they're trapped in a room with the minutes ticking away. That's compared to a boardroom, where answers aren't always so simple.
People in an escape room, where they know that there is a correct answer and the tasks are pretty specific, if they feel like they're good at those tasks, like maybe it's a spatial reasoning type task or solving an anagram, they might feel more confident and more willing to speak up, whereas they wouldn't in other circumstances.
Not all escape the room players know the other people in the room. If you don't book all the slots, you can end up problem solving side by side with total strangers. Swartout says in those situations, people are forced to form relationships fast.
Very quickly, people adopt social roles, leaders, followers, that kind of thing.
There are interruptions during our hour-long game. Game masters, like Hank, watch players via cameras and feed clues through a screen mounted on the wall. Swartout calls game masters amateur psychologists.
Because they really have to keep a sense of the mood of the room and the social norms of the room. For instance, when people are starting to have doubt in themselves and starting to kind of lose their momentum and maybe lose hope that they'll get out of the room, that's when you give another clue to keep the momentum up and keep people energized and keep them moving. And that makes it much more satisfying for the participants.
These games aren't just fun. Psychology professor Art Markman says coworkers can learn lessons they'll take back to the office.
One of the other things we know about motivation is it's impossible to do something general. You can't engage with something unless there's a particular specific thing for you to do. One of the fundamental problems a lot of people have is that they stay at that very high level. I want to improve the processes of my business without actually dropping down a level and turning that into a more specific plan.
Back in the office, escape at last. With 3 minutes left, the office workers escape. A couple of the players look visibly relieved. Some are eager to find out what clues they missed and where they went wrong. Laura, the woman who organized the gathering, says it was fun.
It was kind of a blur. We were running around like chickens with our heads cut off for part of it. But I think our dynamic was pretty good.
People aren't just escaping from fake offices around the globe. Some take on much scarier escapes, like the medieval torture room, or an ominously named one called The Basement in Los Angeles.
You've been kidnapped by a madman. He's locked you in the basement. You will have a set amount of time to find all of his keys.
Do you find something?
Decipher all of his clues and solve all of his puzzles before he comes back to finish the job.
Whoa, what was that? Go back. Right there, what was that?
Psychology professor Art Markman says these frightening escapes, like horror movies and haunted houses, actually offer players an additional experience.
We have this whole range of emotions we're capable of experiencing, and some of them are ones that it's hard to experience safely. So the fear system, for example, where you have some really terrible thing that you're trying to avoid, well, in real life, it's hard to engage with that system in a way where you get to really savor the experience of the emotion while also escaping something really noxious.
No thanks. I'll stick with escaping from rooms full of broken printers, not torture equipment. For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Alana Gordon, Todd Bookman, and this week we welcome Irina Zhorov to our team. She is our new science reporter, and we are very excited to have her here. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager, our associate producer, Joel Patterson, the managing editor, and Megan Pinto, our executive producer. I want you to check out our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, leave us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Here are some recent ones we've gotten. Yo Adrienne says, I love the compelling and sometimes very personal storytelling of the show. I feel like I'm always learning about something that would be difficult to understand otherwise. Unami Queen writes, I admit to being a bit of a geek when it comes to medical information and issues, so this program is perfect for me. And B. Davis 927 writes, it's fun and I learn things. It's fun and I learn things, so you're just one step away from being like Tyrion Lannister on Game of Thrones.
I drink and I know things.
Just kidding. We love hearing from you. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.